Okay, good morning. Welcome back to Social Psychology. Today we will be talking about self and identity. Special welcome to all the school students who are here on their Schnuppertage. I hope you enjoyed. So last week we talked about attribution, and we will continue talking about it when we go through the multiple choice test items in a moment. Today, self and identity, and then from next week on, we talk about attitudes quite a lot. We talk about attitudes, attitudes change, but also social influence has a lot to do with attitudes. I think maybe the research on attitudes is one of social psychology's most important contribution to the field of social sciences and psychology in general. So, last week I presented you theories on attribution, how we attribute our own and other people's behavior, and we also discussed the biases, errors, mistakes we make when we try to attribute our own and other people's behavior. And here are some sample items. The theory that deals with how people construct causal explanations is causal identity theory, cognition theory, attribution theory, or categorization theory. I thought it was fairly obvious that when we talked for 90 minutes about attribution theories, that attribution theory was the correct answer, and so thought 96% of all those who had participated in the online assessment. It was about 56 people who had participated in the online assessment. Again, I can only encourage as many as possible to run these little tests. As more people participate, we have a more representative sample. I don't know why these 4% gave slightly different answers or incorrect answers. There's no such thing as causal identity theory. There's an identity theory in sociology, and there's a social identity theory in social psychology. We will talk about social identity theory a lot in the weeks to come and a little bit also today, but there's no such thing as a causal identity theory. Categorization theory is also a little bit more too general. There is a theory that we will be referring to in a couple of weeks' time that is called self-categorization theory, but it has nothing to do, or only very little to do, with attributions and causal attributions. And cognition theory also is a far too broad a term for theories in social psychology. There are more specific theories that fall under the broad label of cognition theories, such as cognitive dissonance theory or theory of cognitive reactance, that we will cover today and in the next week. Okay, so most of you got this one right. What does the term naive scientist, as coined by Fritz Heider, refer to? A therapist who thinks people usually tell the truth? Someone poorly trained in scientific methods, an ordinary person who thinks like an intuitive scientist, or a first-year student in the physical sciences? Again, most of you got this one right, 87%. Ticked answer C, an ordinary person who thinks like an intuitive scientist. This is what Fritz Heider said, and remember we had that little video with the rectangles and triangles, and Heider said everyone is trying to attribute things. Everyone is trying to underlie meaning and particularly causal meaning to everything we see and observe. We want to live in a predictable world, and to make our world around us more predictable, we use attributions. And everyone means we all are naive scientists. We all think like these naive scientists using methods that intuitive scientists would use. This was a little bit more tricky, probably. According to Fritz Heider again, an example of a situational property. Remember, Fritz Heider suggested a very simple model of attribution theory. He just said, whatever we observe, whatever we see, we want to find an underlying cause, a reason for it, and we have two options. Either we attribute to the person, which would be an internal attribution, or we attribute to the situation around the person, and that would be an external attribution. Now, when you observe someone behaving in a certain way, say someone is talking very loudly to another person, and then you can look for an underlying cause, such as rudeness of this person. What would count as an example of a situational property that we take into account or could take into account when we make an attribution internally, this person is rude, or externally, it's something with the situation? An inborn disposition, a noisy environment, a personality trait, or the sound of the actor's voice. What do you think? Yes, please. B, a noisy environment. Only 63% got this one right, so almost 40% gave an incorrect answer, and in most of these cases, it was the sound of someone's voice. But when you think about it for a moment, you observe someone behaving, talking, shouting, whatever. Now, his or her voice is, of course, a characteristic of the person, not the situation around him. So when you hear him with a quivering voice or with a very loud voice, then you would attribute shyness or rudeness to that person. You would make an internal attribution because of a characteristic in this person, his or her voice. Okay? Personality trait, of course, is something within the person, and an inborn disposition is basically nothing else than personality traits. Yes, please. These questions?
Yes. Is it also on Moodle?
Yes.
But I couldn't find it. I also found it to Moodle.
Let me briefly.
The test is deleted after.
Okay, social psychology. The quiz is probably gone. Preview quiz now. Once you have answered the question, the items are no longer available. The question. Let me just check whether the questions are still in. Okay, so what we probably would need is to upload this version of the slides so that you can check the questions after the lecture again and that they are stored somewhere. Okay, I will take care of this. Okay, final sample question. By deciding that something is due to luck, remember, that was Weiner's theory of attribution that is particularly related or linked to achievement attributions. That something is due to luck. A person would make an external stable, stable and controllable, internal but unstable, or external and unstable attribution. Yes, please. External unstable, that's correct, and so thought most of the participants who had completed the assignment. Okay, so please again, try to do it as much as possible, try to participate in this course, and the same is true for the discussion topics. In the previous 3 weeks, we always had three forums and a forum question related to the next week lecture. We didn't get so much participation, so this week there were about five or six people who contributed, some of them with multiple answers, but on average this is a little bit disappointing for the effort we are investing. So what we thought is probably reduce the number of items to be discussed. And this week we only have two items that we suggest can be discussed among you and the external participants. But I would strongly suggest that you help us participating, exchanging the views. I think that's probably the most interesting and most important part of this course as we have set it up anyway, that you try to apply what we have used here to everyday problems. So one of the topics we suggest to be discussed at the moment is the NSA spionage of US Americans on German politicians. And I'm very interested to see your views and have them exchanged with people in the US or from the US and other countries in the world. So I'm not discussing the discussion topics from last week today because there was only so little participation. There was, however, some participation on the question whether it is good to have a slightly exaggerated, more positive self-esteem. And there was a little debate between two or three people, and I translated this into the following focus question that I would like you to discuss now. What do you think is better? There are basically two options. Do you think it's better to let almost every student pass, as we will do here in social psychology, so only those will fail who have less than 50% correct answers? And I can tell you in the past, almost no student had less than 50% correct answers in the final exam. So almost everyone will pass. Do you think that's good? Because it will help people with their self-esteem. When you all pass, your self-esteem will, of course, not be affected negatively. Or do you consider forced distribution schemes or systems, as many business schools, for example, operate them? So the teacher is only allowed to give a maximum of 30% really good grades, and he's also forced to give at least, for example, 20 or 25% poor grades or even fail grades. Do you think that's better? Because it helps students learn from their mistakes. And probably this is something the participant in the MOOC expressed, something we should all try to do. We should learn from our mistakes. And if teachers don't provide the opportunity to make the mistakes by letting everyone pass, you will never realize how poor you actually may be, that you have to study harder, et cetera, et cetera. So please discuss with your person, one or two people next to you, what option would you prefer and why? Okay, can I have your attention back, please? Yeah, thank you very much. Obviously, this is a topic where everyone can contribute with his or her opinion, and probably some of you have very strong opinions, and the Schlupper-Schüler among us don't know it better, isn't it? So teachers typically assume that there's a normal distribution. And I know that there are some federal states in Germany where school exams have to be repeated when they are on average too poor, but also when they are too good. So when everyone receives a very good grade, eine Eins, then the exam technically would have to be repeated. My wife is a primary school teacher, and when all her students in a math exam get a 1 or 2, she says, oh, the test was too simple. Next time I will make it more difficult. Whereas other models suggest, make the test as simple as necessary and as difficult as necessary. And when all the students can prove that they have learned the material, why not giving everyone a good grade? That's fine. Okay, today we will be talking a lot about self-esteem and how it is related to performance, comparisons with others, etc. And maybe you think about these questions as we go along through the slides. Okay, here are some terms. Most of you have printed off the slides and have them in front of you. In general, today we will be talking about who are we? Who am I? And this is actually a very multifaceted question, and our membership groups, being a professor, being a German, being male, being member of the group of people that wear glasses, being member of the group of 40-somethings, etc., etc., and also the society we come from provide the rules for how we answer this question. And more specifically, we will be talking about some more major perspectives of the self, awareness of and our knowledge about ourselves, where does it come from, why do we categorize ourselves. We will be talking a little bit about social identity today, but even more in a couple of weeks' time when we talk about people in groups. The nature of self-esteem, how we present ourselves to others, and we will be talking a little bit about self-identity and its relationships to culture, national cultures. It's very interesting that the concept of self that we hold today is a really only very recent concept. It has only crystallized over the last, say, 200 years. Before that, people didn't have a sense of being unique individual personalities. And things like secularization, industrialization, the whole Enlightenment movement in the 18th century has brought this to the fore. And as a very recent science, social psychology has tended to view the self as the essence of individuality. Without a sense of who we are individually, there's no individual psychology, and when there's no individual, we can also not talk in social psychological terms about the individual as affected by others and affecting others. One of the fathers of psychology, William James, distinguished between two aspects of the self. He called it a basic duality. It is both the known, the me, or self-concept, which is our knowledge of who we are, but also the knower, the I. And this we can call self-awareness or the act of thinking about ourselves. So you can distinguish between self-concept and the act of thinking about this self-concept, the me and the I, in terms of William James. Tests of human infants suggest that self-recognition develops at about 2 years of age. So before 2 years of age, there is no recognition of the infant being a unique individual. But from 2 years onward, this starts to develop. And other developmental studies show that the concept of self evolves from being very specific, concrete, focused on observable characteristics, to becoming more abstract and focused on psychological characteristics. And this happens during later childhood and adolescence. Of course, in reality, there are many different forms of our self and our identity. And the three most important of these are the collective self. This is the self defined in terms of our group and societal memberships. Our individual self, it's how I define myself in terms of attributes that make me unique relative to other people. And there's a final aspect or facet to the self, the relational self. This is how I define myself in relation to other people, my family, my boss, my students, etc. And people, of course, experience different selves in different contexts. Sometimes I perceive myself more as a member of a collective. Sometimes my own individual characteristics come to the fore, and I would define myself in terms of my personal identity. And at other times, my relational identity is most important or salient in this situation. But we also feel that we have a coherent self-concept. We do not see our self-concept very fragmentized and be a completely different person now than we were yesterday, that we were completely different when we are among others than when we are at home a few hours later or before. But we feel that our different self-concepts are coherent, integrated, and to some extent interrelated. So When you think about yourself and you ask the question, who are you? Think about this for just 5 seconds. What comes to your mind? Who are you? What would be the most important thing that would immediately come to your mind? And there are many different things. There are many self-schemas that can come to your mind. Maybe some of you are more athletic than others, and for some of you, sports is very, very important. So the first thing that you answer when someone asks you, or you ask yourself, who are you, is you are an athlete. You are a sportive person. You run every day, etc. For some of us, family is very important. This relational aspect of self. And you immediately say, I'm a father or a mother or son or daughter. Husband is also the relational self. Photographer can mean two different things. If you are a photographer and you think highly of your photographic skills and you like photographing and shooting pictures and showing them to others, you can either define you as a photographer in terms of your personal identity. It's unique. It distinguishes you from other people who do not have these interests, hobbies, skills, or even occupations, but it can also mean a collective identity. You see yourself as a member of the group of photographers, and you identify with them, and you regularly join meetings of photographers, and you are proud to have this identity together with others. You defend the group when others criticize them, etc. So many different aspects of ourselves are relevant to determine this question, who are you? And it's both personal, collective, and relational aspects. Now, we are, of course, not always continually consciously aware of ourselves. You do not run around every moment and ask yourself, who am I? Who am I now? Who am I in an hour? Have I been an hour ago or so? Self-awareness is sometimes very uncomfortable. Often we don't like being aware of ourselves. At other times it can be uplifting. And this depends on which aspects of the self we are aware of, and of course on the relative favorability of these aspects. This is an experiment by Theiss. Theiss in 1992 had students come into the laboratory and they were asked to present themselves so that they were either emotionally stable or emotionally responsive. And they were asked to do that in two different conditions. In one condition, that's a private condition, they were presenting themselves in a room in front of a camera, but they knew that no one was looking at the other end of the camera. In the public condition, there was a research assistant who was taking notes and who closely paid attention to the student's self-presentation. After that, the students were given a questionnaire, and in this questionnaire, they could emerge either as emotionally stable or emotionally responsive. And here we see that in the public condition, people changed a lot more than in the private condition. So when we publicly present ourselves as a specific type of person, this reflects back on who we answer the question, who we are. Technically speaking, what would have been expected is a flat line, and you see that this line is sticking out. And the difference between the two dark bars in the public condition is much, much higher than the difference between the two light blue bars, which is in fact non-significant. So when you publicly present yourself in a certain way, this reflects back on how you see yourself privately afterwards. So our self-knowledge is stored as schemas, and we have these many different self-schemas, as we have seen a slide ago. They vary in terms of how clear they are. For some of these aspects, we have a very clear conception of what it means to be a good father or husband, or that we are a photographer, and others are more unclear or blurred. And in particularly, we have schemas not only about who we are now, that would be our actual self, but also to other schemas. That is our ideal self, who do we want to be, and our ought self, who do we think we should be. And we often compare our actual self with either our ideal or our ought selves. And when there are discrepancies, it makes us feel bad. But it can make us feel bad in different ways, and I will show you a small experiment in a moment. The set of beliefs we hold about who we are is called the self-concept, while self-esteem is the evaluation we make ourselves. Okay, so we can have a self-concept that has both positive and negative aspects. Our self-esteem is the degree of positivity or negativity we draw from these aspects of our self-concept. And we have both an overall self of self-esteem, so you can think of yourself in a fairly positive way in general, but there are also various self-esteems related to specific domains. So you could say, in general, I'm a good person and I'm capable, I'm intelligent, but when it comes to statistics, I'm not that good. And that's perfectly okay. It would make it still a coherent sense of self. It only depends on your ideals and your odds whether this negative self-esteem in some domains can make a problem for your more general self-esteem. We also have implicit or less conscious self-esteem as well as explicit self-esteem. This implicit-explicit is a very important distinction in social psychology and in psychology in general. We always talk about explicit attitudes when you can consciously tick an answer in a questionnaire, when you can consciously articulate who you are, whether you have prejudices, whether you think of yourself positive or negative. That's all explicit. Implicit means you are not consciously aware of your negative or positive aspects. And next week, when we talk about attitudes, we will also see that psychologists have relatively good methods to get to our implicit knowledge or implicit attitudes, which means you could not articulate them when you would be asked, but we have some methods with which we can find out your true attitudes or the attitudes that are hidden in the unconscious. Okay, and the same is true for self-esteem. For some aspects, you are well aware of them, and you could note them down, write them down, and other aspects are hidden and unconscious. Where does our self-esteem, our self-concept come from? It comes from socialization, reflected appraisal, self-perception, social comparison, social identity, and one particular aspect of social identity, our ethnic identity. And I will go through these sources of self-concept or self-knowledge one by one. Socialization means how we acquire the rules, standards, values, norms of our family, group, and culture. So this tells us a lot about who we are in relation to all these things. And someone who is constantly violating standards or values of family, groups, or culture will be reminded of that by others, by parents, by teachers, and he will have a different self-concept than people who always obey to the rules, standards, and norms. Reflected appraisals is self-evaluation based on the perceptions and evaluation of others. And this can happen all the time. So socialization, we talk about socialization mostly when we think about children and adolescents. But of course, socialization can also happen at later stages, when you join a new university, a new program, when you start to work and you join a new organization or department within the organization. Then socialization starts anew and you get accustomed to the norms and values and standards in this very group. But typically we think about socialization when we are educated and trained through our teachers, peers, parents in the first 18 or 20 years of our life. reflected appraisals also can happen all the time. When you are an employee and you have your annual appraisal with your supervisor, with your boss may tell you positive things about your recent performance or past year's performance, or he or she may tell you negative things about your performance in the past. And this reflects back on how you perceive yourself. When you get negative feedback by him or her, then your self-esteem drops. When you receive positive feedback, it's of course the opposite. Self-perception theory posits that people sometimes infer attitudes from their overt behavior rather than from their internal state. Some of you may have come by train this morning, and maybe on the main station there were some people asking you for some small money. Sometimes you give them some small money, sometimes you don't. When you think about this 5 minutes later, you may think differently of yourself because of your overt behavior that you have just shown. And if you have donated some money, you may think, oh, I'm a generous person, and you feel good about yourself. If you have not donated any money, a couple of minutes later, you may feel a little bit awkward, and it may come to your mind that you should have given some money, and you feel a little bit badly about yourself. And sometimes we behave without conscious thinking and rational decision making. We just behave, and then we draw the inferences about who we are from having observed ourselves in that situation. Okay, and then social identity, and in particular ethnic identity. I think we will go through social identity theory in more detail anyway and a couple of times, but very briefly. Social identity is a very simple theory that can explain a lot of phenomena in the workplace, in intergroup and international conflicts, in our everyday lives, in relation to other people. Henri Taschwitz created this theory after World War II, Henri Taschwitz was a Polish Jew who had fled the Nazis, and he became a professor at Bristol University in the UK. And he wanted to find out why people do terrible things to others, including things like the Holocaust. And he created a number of small experiments, so-called minimal group experiments, that showed that people, as soon as you put them into categories, start to prefer their own category and discriminate against other categories. We will discuss this in much more detail in 3 or 4 weeks. And from this observation, he derived a very basic theory that only has 2 or 3 basic formulations or propositions. The first is, we all want to feel good about ourselves. We want to maintain or restore positive self-esteem. Every human wants to feel and think positive about him or herself. The second assumption is, we are all members of social groups, but we are also individuals. And both feed into our self-esteem, and sometimes we define ourselves as individuals, and Taschwitz called this personal identity. Sometimes we draw our self-concept from our membership in social groups, and this is our social identity. Taschwitz didn't include the relational self or relational identity into this theory. So either personal or social identity are important for our self-definition. When you think of the conflicts that, what did we discuss last week? Last week we briefly discussed the issue of the American government shutdown, and this colleague from the US said one of the problems is that we only have two parties, and because they always want to stick out very clearly and is very opposed to the other party's viewpoints, you have this conflict, and no single party can go back one step because it would be viewed as difficult. But it would also be difficult for the individuals as members of these parties, because membership in these parties at these times of conflict are so salient, are so important. And when I want to feel good about myself, and part of my self-esteem is drawn from my membership in the Republic or the Democratic Party, then I want to make my party better than the other. And this instills conflict and problems. You have a... Yes. It's Taschfell, Henri Taschfell. So social identity is that part of our individual self-concept that stems from our membership in social group, and Taschfell also defined it. It's not only the cognition, our awareness that we are a member of a certain group, but it's also the value and emotional significance that we attach to that group. And whenever my group membership becomes salient, I act as a member of a certain group, and I draw my self-esteem, self-concept from how my group stands in relation to others. At the moment, our social identity is, I'm the teacher, you are students. So you know how to behave, you know the rules and the guidelines, I know how to behave, I know the standards, guidelines, etc. I feel better than you because teachers typically have much more power. But what would happen if I would start telling sexist jokes? Immediately, there would be no difference between teacher and students, but maybe between men and women here in the classroom. A social category, a group membership that we all have, either male or female, would certainly come to the fore, become important, and in terms of the theory, become salient, that didn't play a role a minute before. But all of a sudden, it becomes important, and we start behaving as members of this respective category and try to defend our group, feel good or bad about the group. Probably the man in this room would feel very bad about the group of men because I'm such a bad example, etc. Okay, and one specific form of our social identity is an ethnic identity. Ethnic identity is therefore a specific group because it typically is very important and it penetrates all aspects of our life, particularly when you are a member of an ethnic minority group, when you are a person of color in the United States, when you are a member of an ethnic minority group such as Turks in Germany. It penetrates so many aspects of our lives, our interaction with others, etc., that it is one of our most important social identities. Okay. We've already mentioned that self-schemas describe how we think about our personal qualities in specific domains, but they also guide our behavior in relevant situations. When being a father is an important reflection of who we are and is one of our deeply held self-schema, then we know how to behave, even when our children are not around and are not present, because we are conscious to the needs of other parents. For example, these self-schemas aid our memory for relevant information. When we are a member of a certain group that is relative for us, we look for information and we keep this information more easily in our memory than information that is not related to this specific self-schema. And it influences our inferences, decisions, judgments, for example, attributions. And last week we talked about the ultimate attribution error. When we are a member of a certain group and we see a member of a different or our own group behave, it does lead to different attributions. Internal, when it's our own group member and it's something positive, external when it's our own group member and it's something negative, and vice versa when we behave, when we observe other group members behave. So another aspect of our self-knowledge is possible self. So we talked about actual self, ideal self, ought self, and there's a final thing that is possible possible selves, the schemas that people hold concerning what they may or could become in the future. So for many of the psychology students here in this classroom, this might mean a therapist, a psychotherapist. What does it mean to be a psychotherapist? I can or could become a psychotherapist, that's my goal, that's my aim. It's different from the ideal self. The ideal self would mean, at the moment, as a student, what would be your ideal? Who would you like to be? But it does not mean which profession do you choose. Once you have chosen the profession of a psychotherapist, you may again think about what would be an ideal psychotherapist looking like, and I would like to be one of these ideal prototypes, or not, or to a lesser extent. Well, if you are a psychotherapist, then you can think of, maybe I will leave this profession after 10 years and only do training or supervision or something like this. And then your possible self would change again. They represent our hopes and fears for the future. And typically they are good because they help us organize and make plans and goals and stick to these plans. Okay? But sometimes there are discrepancies. Sometimes we experience that how we perceive ourselves now and how we would ideally like to be, or how we perceive that others would like us to be, this is not perfectly overlapping. I already mentioned the ideal and the odd self, and a brief experiment by Higgins. Higgins and colleagues in the classroom like this identified students who had either a low discrepancy between their actual and ideal self or between their actual and their odd self. And 4 to 6 weeks later, they invited the students back into the laboratory and they gave them an adjective list with emotions before and after the experiment. So students completed this questionnaire, and then the manipulation took place, and either they were primed with their ideal self or with their odd self, and then they completed the same questionnaire again. Now, students with low discrepancies before didn't change at all. This was expected by Higgins. So people who don't have large discrepancies between actual self and either ideal or odd self weren't affected by the manipulation. So this is only students that had high discrepancies. When these students were primed with their ideal self, they were showing more emotions in terms of dejection. When they were primed with their odd self, they were showing emotions related to agitation. So it seems that when we think about our ideal and how we currently are, and there are large discrepancies, we don't feel good and we feel dejected. When we are primed with who we should be and how we currently are, and we observe large discrepancy, we feel agitated. Okay? So why do we do that? Why do we constantly think about ourselves and self-esteem and all these things? I already mentioned one thing by Henri Tachereau. Basically, we can distinguish between three major motives of self-conception. Self-assessment, to discover what sort of person you are. Self-verification, to confirm what sort of person you are. And self-enhancement, to discover what a wonderful person you are. And typically when we rank order these motives in terms of how often do we follow these motives or how important they are for our self-conception, then people are overwhelmingly motivated by self-enhancement. We don't go through the world and constantly want to find out who we really are. We want to go through the world and be constantly reminded how good we are. This is an overwhelmingly major motive. Self-verification, confirming of what we already think we are, is the second most important motive. And true self-assessment, our motive for finding out who we are, comes a distant third. This is probably because self-enhancement services or helps or improves our self-esteem, and self-esteem is very important. Some people have generally higher self-esteem than others, and it's good for them, because we know that people with high self-esteem have a clear and stable sense of self. They have a self-enhancement orientation even more than people with low self-esteem. People with low self-esteem are less clear about their self-concept, and they rather are protective and not enhancing their self-esteem. And here are some differences between people high and low on self-esteem. Things that have been found in a lot of research. So people high on self-esteem are, for example, more persistent and resilient in the face of failure. We all fail from time to time. We have to fail. We cannot win everything and make everything perfect and always get the best possible grades. But people high on self-esteem try again, try to learn from it. They are more persistent. People who are low on self-esteem are vulnerable. If there are negative everyday events, they feel negatively affected by them and feel even more poor or bad about themselves. People high on self-esteem are emotionally stable, whereas people low on self-esteem have wide swings in mood and affect. People high on self-esteem are less easily persuaded and influenced. Typically, this is something that is quite good. People low on self-esteem are easily persuaded and influenced by others. Okay, so there's a number of factors. I'm not saying that self-esteem is good for everything or is always good. We know from some research that positive self-esteem makes, for example, good managers. Self-esteem is one of the attributes that distinguishes people who become managers from people who don't become managers. But it has also been shown that too high a self-esteem for managers is a negative thing, because managers also need to be open for some criticism. They also need to be open to change direction if the situation, etc., changes. So too high a self-esteem is also a potential threat or a potential downside. But in general terms, high self-esteem is better than low self-esteem. And now think back about the little focus question, and maybe think about the 9 or 10-year-old students that my wife is teaching. What is better for their self-esteem? Is it better to constantly be affirmed in their positive self-esteem? Or is it better to learn from failures and mistakes and repeat a class and be told that, no, this wasn't good, it's only a 4 or a 5, and maybe it's better for people to pass. Maybe in specific situations people need more affirmation than others. Maybe it's different from executive MBA students, 40-year-old people with 10 years work experience. Maybe they can stand being told, oh no, your assignment was not perfect, and therefore I can only give you a C for it, and please learn from it, and next time you will do better. So maybe we should be sensitive and attuned to individual people's needs. And maybe little children are more vulnerable than mature people or older people. Okay? People pursue self-esteem for many reasons, probably mainly because it is a good internal index for social integration, acceptance, and belonging. This is very important. Every human has a need for belonging. We want to be members of groups. We want to belong to others. We want to affiliate. We will talk about this 2 or 3 times in this lecture, where we talk about affiliation, attraction, and love in, I think, the second last lecture before the exam. Then I will show you some studies by Spitz and others that have shown when you put people in isolation, it extremely negatively affect their development. Not only their social development, but also their cognitive development. So having this motive, this need for belongingness, is certainly something that is good for us, that has an evolutionary basis that helps us with more positive development. And maybe having a positive self-esteem is an internally is a good index that says, yes, I'm part of a group, a team, a society. It may also indicate that one has successfully overcome loneliness or social rejection by others. To protect or enhance self-esteem, people therefore carefully manage the impression they project on others. Think about this. Think about you today. When did you carefully manage the impression that you have on others? You got up this morning. Some of you spent a little more than others in front of your clothing cabinet, in front of the mirror. Some of you brushed your teeth before you came here. Because you carefully manage the impression you have on others. We don't want to smell bad when we come into this classroom. We try to dress nicely and properly. We also try to dress according to the standards and norms of our groups. And when our social identity is important to us, we follow the rules and standards of this group. If you would go to a lecture of the economists, for example, on average, people are slightly differently dressed than you are. And I'm not saying this is good or bad. You would stick out if you would sit here with suit and tie. You would also stick out if you would come here with an evening dress or your sports costume. But this is the way psychologists and school students are dressed. And we want to carefully manage the impression of others. How many people are wearing? No single person wearing a hat today. This seems to be the latest fashion. We're constantly running around with a cap. Yeah, but my little son, my 17-year son hasn't... Tell him, please. Okay, and sometimes we do that strategically. We manipulate others' images of us. Sometimes, expressively, we behave in ways that project a positive image of ourselves. But we constantly do it, quite often, quite regularly. I already mentioned this. Okay, self-verification. So you have a self-concept. You think you are a person X, Y, Z with positive and maybe also a little bit less positive aspects. So to verify what a good person you are, you constantly and actively seek out situations that confirm your self-concept. So when you know that you are not a good athlete, you are more likely to avoid sports. When you know that you are knowledgeable about math and statistics, you seek out for situations in which you can verify that you are good in math. So, for example, you might offer courses in statistics. You might volunteer for analyzing the data in your experimental practicum, etc. So we seek out actively for situations that verify who we think we already are. Self-enhancement refers to the need to hold a positive view. We already mentioned this. And sometimes positive illusions can help maintaining this positive self-esteem. Positive illusions refer to mild, falsely positive, self-enhancing perceptions of our own personal qualities. So when we are an average soccer player, we might have the mild positive illusions that we are slightly better than average. So yes, we are good at it and we do it well, but we think, all of us do, that we are maybe in the 60s or 70s percent quartile of our team. a less than mild positive illusion would be that a hobby or an amateur football player thinks he could play the national team. This, of course, would reflect negatively on his or her self-esteem. So mild positive illusions are good. Unrealistic positive illusions are detrimental to our self-esteem. And I said that we typically go for self-enhancement. Sometimes we go for self-verification. And we are less likely to really look for who we really are. But sometimes we do. Sometimes we go for an unrealistic assessment rather than a self-enhancing motive. When do we do that? When we are about to receive feedback from others. So when we are about to have our annual appraisal with our boss, when we are about to have an oral exam with our teacher, then we are more likely to be more realistic. When we make decisions about our goals, and as you can see, this is very important, when we make decisions about goals that we really want to achieve, really want to go for and accomplish in the near or distant future, then it's good to be more realistic than self-enhancing. It's good to know who you are and what you can and cannot do, than to think how a wonderful person you are and that everything is possible. And when people are depressed or have low self-esteem, so depressed people in depressive phases or people with generally low self-esteem are also more realistic than self-enhancing. And this is maybe part of the depression. This is part of the problem.
But don't you think that is the other way around? If someone is depressed, I guess they are a lot more negative than they are positive. I would not call that realistic.
Yeah. Both. I think both is true. So people who are depressed are negative and think less than realistic about themselves. But also because they tend to be realistic than self-enhancement, they constantly experience negative things more than those who are normal in a way and slightly exaggerated. So I think it goes both ways, and it's a self-affirming process. Okay, sometimes we experience, realistically or not, that we are not good, that we have done something wrong, that we have violated standards, that we have done something that we would not normally do, etc. And self-affirmation theory predicts that people will cope with these threats to their self-worth by affirming unrelated aspects of ourselves. Unrelated aspects. So, for example, there were experiments in cognitive dissonance theory where participants have been made doing things they would not normally do, like telling little lies or so, and then they had the option to describe themselves as a good person in a completely unrelated questionnaire. And later on, their cognitive dissonance was measured, and they were lower on cognitive dissonance when they had this opportunity to self-affirm in an unrelated aspect of themselves than when they didn't have this opportunity. This is also, I think, the immediate response students typically have. When my son gets home and he received two grades, and one is a poor grade, he would say, okay, I've got a 4 or 5 in math, but look, I've got a 2 in my oral contribution to theater and drama. It's an unrelated aspect of himself that makes him feel good about himself, affirms his self-worth in one area, and that reduces the negative aspects of the problems in the other area. And people higher in self-esteem use that more often, and self-affirming may help people be less defensive and also more accepting of criticism. This is why managers learn to do appraisals in certain ways. This is how we all learn to criticize. I think we have all, it's almost, hardwired in our brain. How do you criticize people after a presentation, after a lecture, after whatever? You say, Thank you very much for this lecture. It was very interesting, but, and then you start the criticism. So we affirm people's self-worth in general or in specific areas, which makes them more tolerant and more accepting of criticism in specific other areas. Okay, now a theory, and the question that we pose on the MOOC is related to that theory. It's called terror management theory. This theory was developed by Greenberg and Prashinsky. I'm not writing down Prashinsky. Greenberg is on the next slide. It's not about managing terrorists. It's the theory that people are fearful of their own mortality. We all are going to die one day. Some of us get older, others die, unfortunately, a little bit younger, but we will eventually all die. And be reminded on our mortality causes what Greenberg and colleagues said, terror. It's a terrifying thought. We will die. I will not be here anymore in whatever number of years. And this causes terror in people, and we seek to minimize the anxiety that is involved with that terrifying thought of our own vulnerability and mortality. And typically we do that by holding a cultural worldview that makes sense of an otherwise threatening world. Yeah. When you open the newspaper this morning or when you watch the news on television this evening, then you will see that most of the stories you hear are negative. There are murders, there are hurricanes, there are robberies, all sorts of negative things happen. But one part of the cultural worldview that protects us to not feel constantly anxious about them is that we think, okay, but these negative things happen to bad people, and I'm not a bad person, so these things would not happen to me. Or they happen at very distant places in the world, or in distant times. Religion can count as a worldview as well, so we feel embedded in a religious school of thoughts that says, okay, it might be unfair now and I have to go through this deep valley, but there will be light at the end of the tunnel someday, and I will be rewarded for good deeds and for enduring the pain I have now. I'm not saying this is good, but it helps people overcoming these negative thoughts and cope with their anxiety. It's a form of positive illusions, and it can be mild and helpful and positive, and it can also prevent people from taking the necessary action that they probably should take and not endure the negative things. Yeah, and the second one is similar. This is a typical experiment. Greenberg and people gave participants either positive or negative personality feedback, so feedback about them as a person. And you know that if you receive negative personality feedback, it really does not feel good. If you receive positive feedback of your personality, it feels good. Then they watched a video. And either it was a neutral video, something about flowers or so, or an explicit video about death. What the researchers typically take is videos from surgery where limbs are amputated, it's not nice. Those whose self-esteem was elevated before by receiving positive personality feedback developed far less anxiety as those people who had received neutral or negative feedback. You see, when there's a neutral video, there was similar anxiety whether you received positive or negative feedback before, but people who watch a death video are reminded of the vulnerability, etc., and when they have not the ability to cope with that because they feel good about ourselves due to the positive feedback they just received, their anxiety is increasing significantly and substantially. Any question?
Somehow, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that mutual video was, and I don't know if you know, but somehow people had that score of 20 or something, so I don't know if a zero is the level or if they're starting at 20, because I think the flowers are so frightening. So.
Yeah.
No.
I don't know how anxiety was measured here, but you see, this level, watching the desk video after you have received positive self-esteem feedback, does not change the anxiety at all. The desk video only increases our anxiety when we don't have this ability to cope by having received positive feedback. That's all this graph tells us. I'm sorry, I don't know the scale or the number of items. Okay, a very important theory. Leon Festinger is one of the most important social psychologists of the last century. He developed two very important theories. Next week we will talk about the theory of cognitive dissonance that Festinger developed in 1957. In 1954, he developed the theory of social comparison. This theory contends that people have a drive to evaluate their opinions and abilities accurately. When there are no objective standards, people evaluate themselves by comparison with others. When there are objective standards, fine, we just compare ourselves against these objective standards. When there's a Mindestlohn, then everyone who earns relatively little money can compare him or her own income against this Mindestlohn. When there's no objective standard, then people compare their own salaries or incomes with that of others. And in general, people prefer comparisons with similar others. This means similar in terms of relevant attributes. So when it's about income, then you would not compare with similar others in terms of gender or age or hair color. You would compare with people who do similar jobs. The goals of social comparison are first accurate self-evaluation, that's what Festinger claimed, but there can also be two other aims or goals. One is self-enhancement, as we already know, this is what people typically look for, and this therefore typically leads to downward social comparisons. We prefer to compare with those who are a little bit less well off than we are, who are a little bit less capable or less skilled, because this makes us feel good about ourselves. This is what you typically do as a student when you receive a mark of, say, a 3. You compare with those who have a 3- or a 4. You don't compare with those who have a 1. However, sometimes we also compare upwardly when our goal is self-improvement. Sometimes we have the goal to be good in certain things, and then we orient ourselves on those who are slightly better than we are because we know we can learn from them. And the final goal of social comparison is also having a sense of communion. When we compare ourselves with others, it feels good to recognize that we are ordinary and normal and that we think just like others do. Social comparison affects our self-evaluations, our moods, our responses to others. There was one experiment by Morse and Gergen. There was an advert for becoming a research assistant. Candidates were invited and had to wait in a room with either a Mr. Clean or a Mr. Dirty. Mr. Clean was very properly dressed and mentioned that he was well prepared for the interview and had good grades, etc., etc., and Mr. Dirty was just the opposite. Those who found themselves in a room with Mr. Clean experienced a drop in their self-esteem and the opposite was true for Mr. Dirty. I already mentioned the related attribute similarity. It refers to comparing ourselves with others based on similarity in background preparation. Sometimes, however, a dimension is completely unfamiliar. We, for the first time ever, sit this test. We have never done something similar before. And to help us orient how good we are, we compare ourselves to both the best and the worst attributes. Self-presentation, I did already mention this. We typically tend to make a good impression, typically by conforming to the norms of the situation, by self-promotion. We slightly talk about our advantages more than our disadvantages. Also, ingratiation is a type of self-presentation. When we talk to our boss or when we talk to someone who we want to do us a favor, then we typically say something nice about them, or we do them a favor and hope that they will reciprocate. And of course, self-promotion can be tricky because it appears easily as egoistical. However, when we not engage in self-promotion and when we are modest about our own skills and abilities and performance, this is also a tricky presentation strategy and is only effective when we know that the person we talk to already knows how good we are, okay? When you have wonderful grades from the best schools in the country, etc., then you don't need to boost with it in a job interview because you can count on the interviewer having your certificates in front of him or herself anyway. So promotion would be not a very clever strategy. However, when you meet someone on a social event and you might think about this person could give you a job, then of course you need to tell this person about your performance in the past because he doesn't already know. So sometimes modesty is good, sometimes self-promotion is good, and we have to be smart about when we use which of these strategies. People with independent self-concepts, we talk about independent and interdependence in a moment, are more likely to engage in self-promotion because their goal is to reduce actual and ideal discrepancies. Typically, people in the Western world have more independent self-concepts. People in Eastern cultures have more interdependent self-concepts related to others. Relational identities and social identities are more important to them, and they are more likely to engage in preventive self-presentations because they want to reduce actual and odd self discrepancies. Being modest. Not boosting. When you, let's take the situation of a job interview. And you could go into that job interview and either boost about your past performance or be very modest about this past performance. Then being modest about it reduces the risk that if you were given the job, you would find that you cannot do it the way you are ought to do it. Whereas when you boast about your performance and you are not able, then the ones with the independent self find themselves that they cannot perform on the level they themselves would ideally like to see them on. Okay? Okay, that final, I think it's a final self-strategy, it's self-handicapping. It refers to engaging in actions that provide obstacles to success so that failure later on can be attributed to those obstacles and not to your personal skills, abilities, etc. Remember the little experiment we discussed last week when people were made solving unsolvable puzzles and then were told that they were really good. And then they had the choice to take Acthavil or Proctavil, a self-enhancing or reducing drug. And those who thought that they are probably not going to solve the puzzles a second time because they were working on the insolvable puzzles before and attributed their success to luck, they chose the performance-reducing drug as a self-handicapping strategy, because afterwards they could say, okay, I didn't do well the second time because I took the drug. Okay? And talking about drugs, men are more likely than women to use behavioral self-handicaps. Typically, it's going and party hard the night before the exam. Because if you fail the exam, you could later on tell everyone, yeah, it was just because I drank so much. If I hadn't, I would have passed the exam with flying colors, of course. Women also engage in self-handicapping, but they use more verbal strategies than behavioral ones, but men do use verbal strategies as well. As you can imagine, it may work in the short term, but it can also have negative long-term consequences for performance and adjustment. Okay. And now the final 10 minutes on the self-reference effect. When information is relevant to our self-concept, we process it faster than when it is not, and we remember it better. Typically, we see ourselves as center stage. We see ourselves as center of the universe. And a nice little study is the name-letter effect. The name-letter effect refers to the tendency that people evaluate alphabetical letters in their own names particularly favorable. And you've just completed the survey, so you can check for yourself, did you evaluate your own first or second name initial better than all the other letters of the alphabet? This effect... Sorry, can I have your attention back? This effect is very stable. So it has been found in numerous studies and everywhere in the world, at least in 14 different countries. The effect is more than a mere exposure effect. So you could say, yes, the first letter of my first name and of my surname, I write them so often. So I see it more often and therefore I like it more. This is what we call mere exposure. But mere exposure would count if I ask 20-year-old students or 25-year-old students. This would be the same for the first initial of your first name and of your surname. However, in cultures, and there's one study in Japan, in cultures like the one in Germany, where women still tend to assume the name of their husbands after wedding, after marriage, the effect is stronger, much stronger for the first name initial than for the last name initial, but only for women. So men who know that they keep their surname have preferences for both initials of their first and surname. The effect also occurs in relation to your birthday numbers, so day of the month or month of the year. And it has shown, and this is the important or the interesting thing, it has shown to have clear preferences. For example, for brand names, Hodson and Olsen showed that Hazels like Honda cars more than Nissans, whereas Nicks like Nike more than Adidas, Carl likes Coke more than Pepsi, etc. So there's a lot of marketing research that has shows it does influence our choices of products. And it suggests that people are not consciously aware of it. So it's automatic associations about themselves that may influence feelings about almost anything that they associate with self. Now, the question from Pelham and colleagues was, does it influence our behavior? does it really influence your behavior in important way, in for important decisions? Where do we want to live, and which occupation do we take or do we go for? And this was published in 2002 in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, the most influential journal in social psychology, very high impact journal, and they present numerous studies. I don't know, I think it's a 10 study paper, and I only give you a few examples of it. The first study they did was women with the name Mildred live more likely in the United States, federal state of Milwaukee, and less likely in Virginia. Virginians are more likely to live in Virginia Beach than to live in Milwaukee. These are because of relatively high numbers. These are highly significant results. But you can also see that the differences are quite substantial. So in brackets, you see the expected number of people. So you would expect 800 Mildreds living in Milwaukee. In fact, it's 860. But you would expect 600 Virginians to live in Milwaukee, but it's only 450. And this effect continues and continues. Yes, please?
Yeah, but it's really the cause effect is really that way that Virginians live there.
Yeah.
Parents say, oh, I love Virginia. I'm really not creative. I don't like Virginia.
Yeah, they've checked. They checked for it, and in some of their studies, they only analyze people who have recently moved to the country. Same is true for men. So Jacks are more likely to live in Jacksonville. Phillips more likely to live in Philadelphia. When we look for surname letters and the likelihood that people live or move to different states, you see that people whose first name starts with Kelly are more likely than expected to live in California. Flories are more likely to live in Florida, etc. The expectation number is just based on counting the baseline and the total effect. So this is a typical chi-square testing. So when you see here that there are more Jacks in total living in these two states than Phillips. And therefore the expectation is counted that if everything else was equal from these 1,400 people, how many Jacks would you expect in comparison to the number of male people living in Philadelphia in total,
from
proportional, yeah.
Probably,
we should do research on that. Moving to a state. This was living in a state, related to your question. This was living in a state. This was moving to a state. So here the researcher explicitly looked at who had recently moved into this state. And you see here many, many more Florences have moved to Florida than Georgias, Louises, or Virginias. Virginias moved much more often to Virginia than expected. Looking at the number of the birth date and likelihood of living in a specific city, people who were born on February the 2nd live more likely in cities with the name Two, like Two Harbors. People born on 3rd of March are more likely to live in Three Oaks, and so on and so forth. And even more interesting, and this is the final slide from this study, people with names Denise, Dana, Dennis, Dana, Dennis, Dennis, Denny, or Denver are much more likely to work as dentists. Then the lawyers, and the opposite is true for people Laura, Lauren, Lori, Laverne, Lawrence, Larry, and so on. These are highly significant, strong effects. And the authors claim it's all unconscious. You don't constantly think for 18 years or whatever, oh, my name is Dennis, I should better start studying becoming a dentist. It's very unconscious. It's implicit preferences for everything that is related to yourself. This is the result from the questionnaire that we presented to students 3 years ago. and you see a strong preference for both the first and the last name initial, you see that because women are in the majority here, also the difference between first letter in your own names and in all other, for all other letters in the alphabet, are much smaller than for the first name. It may again having to do with the fact that still in Germany more women assume the name of their husband than vice versa. And this is the effect for all letters of the alphabet, and you see that with only very few, one or two exceptions, the own letter is liked more and sometimes much more than the average of the other letters in the alphabet. And final slide, cultural differences in self and identity. I already mentioned independent and interdependent self. Independent selves are more bounded, unitary, and separate from the social context, conceptualizations. Interdependent self is the sense that we are flexible, variable, and connected to the social context. And people in the Western world typically develop independent, in more Eastern or Latin countries, more interdependent selves. And you see that the Western culture emphasizes uniqueness. People need to stand out with individual properties and individual accomplishments. They see themselves more often separate from others and observe themselves as more stable across situations. People in Asian countries see themselves more emphasizing relationships they are having. They are more flexible across situations. And they don't emphasize their individual uniqueness, but they emphasize shared attributes. There's a number of experiments also in the recent years that has confirmed that by and large this is true. However, this is changing a little bit over the last 10 years or so in the direction that people in Eastern cultures also become more and more individualistic. But still, on average, you find these differences. This was it for today. Thank you very much and see yourself next week.